Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering radiation cancer treatment from over 30 physicians at 20 locations in the Charlotte regional area. Details at treatcancer.com.
Hey, y'all, I'm Tommy Tomlinson. And from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound. Have you ever heard that little voice telling you to do something more with your life? Kathy Izzard heard that voice, and unlike many of us, she decided to listen to it. In 2007, she quit her graphic design business to start working on a project to find homes for the homeless in Charlotte. That led to a building called Moore Place, which now houses 120 people who were formerly among the city's chronically homeless. 2 years ago, Izzard wrote and self-published a book about her journey called The 100-Story Home. The book sold so well that a division of HarperCollins, one of America's big publishing houses, is putting out a new edition on June 26th. Kathy Izzard listened to that little voice, and it changed not just her life, but the lives of the homeless in her city. Here's our conversation. Kathy Izzard, I have a point of style first. You grew up in El Paso, right?
Grew up in El Paso, Texas.
Yeah, so the executive committee of this podcast met before we even started doing it, and we agreed to allow Texas into the South.
Oh, you did.
But my question to you, as somebody who grew up there, is two questions, really. Is Texas really the South, and is El Paso in particular really the South?
No, great question. No, I think Texas believes they're a nation unto themselves, honestly, maybe. Right. Even though, yes, they're incorporated sometimes with the South. And El Paso, seriously, could just succeed into New Mexico and no one in Texas would ever notice. So we are so far out on the West Texas border that it sometimes doesn't feel like we're part of Texas. So.
Well, even so, we're provisionally going to let you in for the purposes
Thank
of this.
Thank you so much. I have been in Charlotte a long time, so hopefully that qualifies
me. I think
me.
That's fair. That's fair. So in the house you grew up in Texas, I know it, as you wrote in your book, it may have seemed pretty ordinary from the outside, but on the inside, it was a little different, right?
Yes. And I don't, I think everyone thinks their own home is ordinary, right? I think everyone thinks that the way they're growing up is the way everyone's growing up. And I don't know that it really occurred to me until much later, maybe even in my 40s, when I started raising my own children and reflecting on what it was like to be a mother and to have children and to need to be present so much, that I really realized that having a mother who had struggled with a bipolar disorder, probably from the time I was 6 years old until really for 16 years, when I was 22, she was finally properly diagnosed, properly got the correct medications and the correct treatment. So really all my formative years, my mother was kind of in and out of treatment and in and out of really of her own life. She calls it the lost years.
And most of those years until she got that diagnosis, things would just happen and you guys really couldn't put much of a name on it, right?
We really didn't. She was misdiagnosed for years. So she was misdiagnosed as a paranoid schizophrenic when bipolar was the correct diagnosis, a much less severe mental health challenge. But I think mostly we did what a lot of families do is we hide it. We didn't talk about it. Mom would go away or be hospitalized and we'd all get up and go to school and Dad would go to his law practice and we'd carry on.
Yeah. And I want to ask you later on kind of specifically how that influenced or affected your work with the homeless. But setting that aside for just a minute, what other things do you think growing up in that situation maybe taught you about life or has helped you or influenced you later?
Well, I think I didn't realize a couple of things. One, I didn't realize the resiliency that was building within me. It built a certain self-reliance and independence, which has turned out to be really valuable in my life. But I think none of that would have happened if I hadn't had a father who was very, very present and really tried to be with us, and in-town grandparents who picked up a lot of the needed slack as well. So I think we were fully supported. That's why it really took me till I was 40 to really think that that was an odd way to grow up or to think any of that was unusual. Uh-huh. I've had readers talk to me, you know, in kind of hushed tones of like, I'm so sorry about your childhood, or you had such a dysfunctional upbringing. And I think, no, I really didn't. I thought I had a pretty happy childhood. It wasn't until later that I looked at it any differently.
It's like not knowing you're poor until you see somebody who's rich, right?
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. I did. I kind of thought everybody was crazy or had some craziness, which I still stand by. I think that's kind of true.
I fully agree with that. So let's skip ahead to your 40s. So you're living what, by all accounts, sounds like a pleasant, comfortable life in Charlotte.
Yes.
You're a graphic designer.
Yes.
Right. You're married and you're raising daughters.
Yes, we have
Four daughters. And then you decide there's an itch or something, right? Sort of describe what got you into volunteering, reaching out sort of in the first place.
Right. I think, well, it was a two-part. I had been raised to do good. I was always raised that we're supposed to leave the world a better place. And that, I think, came from my father in particular, that we're really supposed to give back and leave the world a better place. And so I had been volunteering down at the Urban Ministry Center with my family, and that was part of the doing good. I really did not think that was a place where I might be able to do more. I really viewed homelessness as kind of a black hole of a problem that couldn't be solved, you couldn't do anything about, and probably serving soup with a smile was about the best any of us could do. But at the same time, in my 40s, I was seeing my four girls getting older. I had had big dreams for them. We certainly had academic dreams for them. I was excited about what they were going to do with their lives. And it started occurring to me, as I was looking at Empty Nesthood, I'd forgotten what my own dreams were. And I really couldn't remember what they were. But I knew that I'd been doing graphic design for almost 20 years. I knew it kept me busy. It did not fill my soul. I was doing a lot of nonprofit work for my clients, and I was always struck when I left those meetings how I wished I was doing their work and not mine. That just giving them the logo or the brochure and sending them off on their way to do good in the world, I always was wistful, thinking I was wishing I was doing their work and not the work I was doing. And so I think that started this place of restlessness, of knowing that I wasn't going to do graphic design for the rest of my life, but I didn't really know what I could do. And I didn't feel qualified to do anything except what I was doing. And with four daughters, I didn't think going back to school was an option, getting any kind of master's or graduate degree. And honestly, I didn't know what kind of degree I would get. What kind of degree do you get for doing good in the world? Social work or nonprofit management.
There should be something, right?
Yeah, but I don't know. A general do-good degree didn't seem to be popping out of any course catalog. So I was a little lost and searching, but not really knowing what I was searching for.
And so you ended up volunteering at the Urban Ministry Center, which is in uptown Charlotte. There lots of people who listen to this are not from Charlotte. So sort of describe what Urban Ministry
right.
does.
The Urban Ministry Center is an interfaith center. So it does not preach any one part of religion to get help. It is the soup kitchen. So it is where people who are experiencing homelessness come not only to get a daily meal, but also showers, laundry. We have counselors. We have medical services. And back when this was all happening in 2007, we really had all kinds of programs, art programs, soccer programs, gardening. It was really, in my mind, state-of-the-art homeless services. Mm-hmm.
But when you started, I also remember you writing that you worked there and volunteered and did good, but you were also sort of detached. You kind of hid sometimes from some of the more, you say it.
I think for probably 10 years, I stayed very detached. To me, we would come once a month on a Sunday and I would take our girls down there. Honestly, we ended up there because on Sunday mornings, it was much easier to get them in their jeans and t-shirts and sneakers and take them down to the Urban Ministry Center than it was to put them into the tights and patent leather shoes and smock dresses that the South requires for church or seems to require for church. And since I was raising four tomboys, Sunday was always a struggle in getting the girls to do that. So when I saw this ad in our church bulletin for volunteers for the soup kitchen, I thought, well, this is great. We can wear our jeans. We can do good. We don't have to look good. That's how we ended up down there. And the soup kitchen is set up so the volunteers are kind of in the kitchen. And there's a 24-inch steel counter that kind of runs between the kitchen and the dining room where we serve the neighbors. And everyone there who has served is deemed a neighbor. And I stayed in the kitchen for a really long time, probably a good 10 years. Every once a month, those Sundays, my girls would go and they'd, you know, take Kool-Aid and they'd take cookies out in the dining room. And I really stayed behind the kitchen counter, I think for two reasons. One, I was a little fearful of, I didn't understand why someone would end up homeless. But I was a little fearful that someone might ask me for something or money, and I wasn't sure how I was going to respond to that. So I thought keeping my distance would eliminate that awkwardness. But I think I was pretty sure. I didn't know what stories were on the other side of the counter, but I was pretty sure that people experiencing homelessness probably had something in common with my mother, and there was probably a lot of mental illness. And I'd never been able to help my mother in my mind, so I was pretty sure I was not going to be able to help someone there. And that was another reason to be fearful and to stay back and stay away, I think.
But then all that changed when you met a guy named Denver Moore, right?
Yes.
Explain who Denver Moore is.
So in 2007, I read a book called Same Kind of Different as Me, and it was by Ron Hall and Denver Moore, and it became a New York Times bestseller.
And a recent movie,
And
right?
a recent movie, yeah. Correct. And I read that book, and it haunted me, and I really couldn't stop thinking about it. And because in that book, Ron Hall and his wife, Debbie, did something fairly remarkable. They were not only volunteering at the soup kitchen, but they ended up befriending Denver, who'd been homeless almost 30 years. And they became more than friends. They became family. And they actually housed Denver. So Denver was no longer homeless. Ron and Debbie ended Denver's homelessness. But I want to be clear that Denver ended up saving them right back. And that was the interesting thing about the book, that Ron and Debbie thought they were going to reach down and save somebody out of homelessness. And meeting Denver and seeing the world differently changed them, transformed them as well. And I think this book haunted me because I knew that in the 10 years I'd been down at the Urban Ministry Center, I had never done something like that. In fact, in the 10 years, I'd probably not even bothered to learn one person's name. And it haunted me in a way that I can't really explain. And I wrote that it started maybe my first whisper, that little voice that tells you to do something that's a little crazy and inconvenient. And so I listened to that whisper, and which kept telling me that I should bring these guys to Charlotte. So I ended up emailing Ron Hall, sending him an email, asking if he would come for a fundraiser. And I don't know why I did that, because I had no authority. And there was no fundraiser plan, but I did anyway. I pressed send.
Did they say yes before you even had a plan to?
Oh yes. 20 minutes later, Ron Hall emailed me back. Sure, when's your fundraiser? So I ended up being in charge of a fundraiser for the homeless, and 1,000 people were coming. And I couldn't figure out why graphic designer mother of four was in charge of this, why I had listened to that. And I know that it's because the day before that fundraiser, I ended up taking Denver down to the Urban Ministry Center. And I was giving him a tour. And I was going to show him all of the state-of-the-art services for the homelessness. And I thought he was going to give us a pat on the back. I thought he was going to maybe give me a pat on the back. And, you know, I was excited to show him everything that we were doing. And so I was taking him around and showing him everything that we were doing, and it wasn't playing out like it had in my head. Denver was actually being very silent, and in a very awkward 25 minutes, he had not said one word. And we got to the end of our tour, and we were standing in the front hall of the Urban Ministry Center, and there were some stairs leading up to our left. And that's finally when he decided to speak. And he said, can we go upstairs now? And I said, well, there's nothing up there. There's just offices. And he said, well, where are the beds? And I thought, well, he wasn't listening on my tour. You know, we're a soup kitchen. We're not a shelter. And he interrupted me and he said, you mean to tell me you do all this good in the day and you lock them out to the bad at night? I had to say, yeah. And he said, does that make any sense to you? I had to say, no. And he said, are you going to do something about it? And I got to say, I had never looked at it that way. I'd never looked at the Irvin Ministry Center, which I think still to this day is an amazing, wonderful organization. And I had never looked at it as locking them out to the bad at night. But that day changed me, and I couldn't ever see it any other way again. And I tried to see it differently. I tried to think that we were doing just fine and right. The status quo was good. But I started not sleeping very well at night. And so 2 months after that day with Denver, I ended up quitting my job and going to work for the Irvin Ministry Center to figure out how would we do better? What did it mean to build beds and what were we going to do about it?
Yeah. Now, I want to be clear, there were temporary options for people like beds at night, shelters, Salvation Army, places like that. There were places where you could go at least on a night-by-night basis.
There were, yes. And what I think I realized at the time was I didn't even understand how many homeless people there were or people experiencing homelessness. And I didn't know how many shelter beds there were. I didn't know that we divided men from women and families. I didn't know any of that. But what I did understand is there was a long line every single day at the Irvin Ministry Center, and there had been for 10 years. And why was that? Why were we seeing the same people over and over and over again? And that's what we needed to solve. Why was I serving the Chili Willy, a lot of folks who grew up in Charlotte? Why was he getting soup with us every day for 14 years? Why was he not going anywhere else?
Right. As part of all this, you guys kind of did a survey of sorts and trying to kind of sort out basically the chronic homeless from people who may be just, you know, one check away from being back in a home or something like that, right? Y'all
correct.
Sort of tried to get a handle on it.
Well, what I learned in that kind of that a crash course, I started in January of 2008 trying to decide, what does this look like? What does it mean to build beds? What are we actually trying to do here? And realized that homelessness is much like any issue. It's not a one-size-fits-all. People experiencing homelessness, there's really three categories. There's chronically homeless. Those are folks who've been on the street year after year and have a disabling condition, whether it's a mental, physical, intellectual, something that's keeping them, their barriers keeping them on the street. They're situational, and that is kind of your family. Maybe the primary caregiver lost the job or had a health crisis, and that family is now kind of thrown into chaos and thrown into homelessness. And then there's episodic, which again applies to families or couples or, you know, groups. And that is when that situation keeps happening over and over again. You know, maybe a year or two will go by, but then they're in chaos and homelessness again. And that's usually because one of the primary caregivers may be like a chronically homeless person, have some sort of disability of mental, physical, and addiction, something that's keeping them from, you know, the glide path that we all try to attain in life.
Right. And I know it's all bad, obviously, but
right.
The chronically homeless are not just a sort of moral issue in some ways, but also a big drain on the cities or counties, wherever that is, resources. I know you talked about that Malcolm Gladwell story that he wrote several years ago about Million Dollar Murray. Do you want to kind of
sure? What we realized in researching and doing the work for what we were trying to do is the chronically homeless, you can either believe that we should house them because we're our brother's keeper and you have a heart for the homeless and you don't like to see humans suffer, but there's also an economic argument, and that it is actually cheaper to house someone than it is to allow them to die on the streets. And we did the numbers and we found out in Charlotte it was costing about $39,000 a year per chronically homeless person, where it was going to house them was going to be about $13,000 a year. So $39,000 a year in jail cells that are misused for shelter, in emergency rooms that are misused for shelter, in hospital bills, police time, court time, all of that, you're going to spend that same $39,000 the next year with no positive results and possibly an individual dying on the street. But you could house them with amazing results, save their life, and it's $13,000 a year.
And Million Dollar Murray came from the idea that I think somebody, this one guy, I believe in Reno, Nevada, they had tallied up that he had used $1 million in resources.
Correct.
Over the years, or that Reno had spent that much basically
during the life of his
picking him
chronic
up the street
homelessness,
and then let him back out, and the cycle continued. So at some point along this way, you and the other folks at Urban Ministry decided you're going to build a place.
We did. We started with a pilot program. In the beginning, when I first started my job, we had had a gift from a family, John and Pat Moore, to try a pilot program, to try this idea of what's called permanent supportive housing. Permanent meaning that you build a place that people can live there as long as they need. Supportive meaning you match them with a case manager and a home, a key, a permanent place to live with no time limit on when they have to give up and out. And it's based on a housing first philosophy. And housing first kind of upends the homeless service world. Traditionally, I think homeless service agencies 2 decades ago would said, well, you know, as soon as you, guy living under the bridge, as soon as you get a job or get some income, come on over to us and we're going to help you find a place to live. And housing first turns that on its head and says, just by the fact that you're a human being, you deserve to be inside. You deserve a home. You should not live outside. Come inside, have a home, and then let's work on what's keeping you, your addiction, your mental health, your physical, your intellectual challenges. So that's what we decided to try and do, and we started a pilot program called Homeless to Homes. We housed our first 4 individuals in May of 2008.
And those were in apartments, right?
In apartments that belonged to a gentleman who was willing to work with us. And it took us 6 months to find him.
I was gonna say, it wasn't easy just to find that, right?
It was not. I mean, we had this money from the Moores that was going to allow us to pay rent and to pay a case manager and to run this program. But once we got to the part with the landlord that the people moving in were coming in directly from street to home, and the conversation kind of ended. I think the fear of people who are experiencing homelessness was really great. No one wanted to risk their apartments with these people. And I put that in air quotes on the radio. But we finally did. We found one gentleman, Mark Bass, and 4 apartments, and we housed those people directly from street to home. There was a woman who was tiny. She's 4'11", and she'd been living under cars. And there was a gentleman who'd been living in the men's shelter for 7 years.
Wait, let me back up. Like under cars, like at night, she would just find a car in a parking lot or something to sleep
under? A gentleman who had been living in the men's shelter for 7 years, which is part of the problem. Chronically homeless were living in shelters designed for 30 days for years on end. A gentleman who'd been living in a barn, and another gentleman who had completed a 28-day drug treatment program but was going to be released from that back onto the streets because he had nowhere to go. And we found out that summer that just like it happened anywhere else is what was happening in Charlotte with these first 4 and then 13, that amazing transformations happen. That once people had 30 days sleep, some people who looked severely and persistently mentally ill were maybe not so crazy and were starting to ask for things like, could you help me get in that drug treatment program? Could you help me get my GED? Or even things as achingly simple as, well, if this is my home, do you think that we could plant some tomatoes? Because I used to love to garden with my grandma.
Yeah.
And all of that really traumatic life started to look just like ordinary living. And we knew that we couldn't just keep it for these 13 people. We realized it was like finding a cure for cancer and we were only going to give it to these 13. Mm. So we started dreaming of having our own building where we wouldn't have to ask landlords for permission and whether we could do more and house more people.
I don't mean to say this in a bad way because it sounds boring what I'm going to say, but in a lot of ways, this book you've written is sort of a memoir of fundraising. You know, a lot of it is about how you and other folks there put together the money to build more place. And there were lots of different places you had to go and lots of different things that had to all fall into place, right?
They did. And I guess that is one of the threads in the story. To me, if I was going to rename this book, it would almost be The Miracle of More Place. Uh-huh. Because this crazy idea to build a building ended up, once you put a price tag to it, was $10 million, which is kind of ridiculous even on the face of it. It was going to be $6 million to build the building and then $4 million for an endowment. If anyone's done capital campaigns, we were going to do an endowment to support the building. But what happened is by the time we got all of this going, it was October of 2008. And the bottom fell out not only in Charlotte, but all around the country. So,
well, especially here because it's such a financial center.
Yes, we're a financial center with two big banks that normally you would have, that would have been your first stop to each bank to ask for money for this project. So we were really looking like we were going to take all of our plans and our dreams and go home. And that's why I wrote the book, is because it all came together in the most miraculous way, from kids who did lemonade stands and sent us $105 to mystery $10,000 checks to, million-dollar miracle gifts that shouldn't have happened in the time of the recession. But it almost felt like in the worst of times, it just brought out the best in everyone, including people in the city who might have judged someone who was on the streets and said, well, why doesn't he get a job? Or how could he have lost everything? All of a sudden, people who had never understood losing anything understood a little bit about losing everything.
I do wonder still, though, how many people feel like this is backwards. There's, as you talked about before, you know, I think people who may be opposed to, let's say, welfare or something like that, and then you come to them and say, we're going to take somebody on the street and we're just going to give them a place to live. Mm-hmm. It might like break their brain or something. How did you talk? Because I'm sure you had to convince at least some of those people.
Oh my gosh, we had 1,000 cups of coffee all over the city and through all kinds of foundations and business people and churches. The folks that we didn't have to convince were the churches, the houses of faith in Charlotte. One in particular did a faith challenge where they gave $250,000 and challenged 50 other congregations to give. And so we ended up getting almost $1 million from Houses of Faith. But yes, there were the businessmen that we sat in the room and tried to explain why this is. And again, if you go to this, homelessness is a large problem. And people who are situationally homeless and who have lost their job, they can get a new job. You can give them, you know, a leg up by a rental deposit on a new place and just a little bit of help. But people who are chronically homeless with a mental illness or an addiction, or, you know, we had individuals with IQs of fifth graders who were living on the streets, that their families could no longer care for them and it kind of abandoned them to the streets. I mean, that's who we were talking about. So I think as a society, you either have to say, well, I'm okay with these people dying on the streets, or you say, no, we're going to care for the least of these, and we are going to be judged by how we take care of the least of these, and we're going to have some place for these folks to go. And I think that's what this community decided to say, is that, yeah, in some cases we are our brother's keeper. In some cases we're not. So there are some people who can support themselves, who can get on. But there are some people in our community that do need some long-term help.
So you got the money. Yes. You started building the thing. And at some point you and your colleagues had to decide who gets in.
Right.
At least in that first group.
Yeah.
What were those discussions like?
So there was a good 3-year stretch in between the pilot program and when this building was built. And we did want to do that much more systematically and have those who are most likely to die on the streets be housed first, which is the only way that we could come up to be fair in a really unfair world of homelessness and tragedy. Okay, who's most likely not going to make it through the night? So we did something called a vulnerability index, and we went and tried over a week period to meet and interview every single chronically homeless person in Charlotte. We went under bridges, we went to jails, we went to the shelters, anywhere that we knew folks stayed, and tried to interview them and ask them a systematic series of questions, and created this list, 1 to 807. We determined there were 807 who would qualify for our building and were chronically homeless.
And just to be clear, that's a fraction of the actual homeless people.
Yes.
At any given moment.
So on a given night, our point in time count at the time was around 6,000. And so point in time means you take account at snapshot who is homeless tonight. And we do that every January. Most communities across the United States do the same type of count. But we found our point in time count for the chronically homeless, and you had to meet a definition that's a federal definition of how long you've been homeless and your disabilities. And we ranked those from 1 to 807 so that when the doors of our magical building would open, that we would start with number 1 on the list, the person most likely to die. and then start working through the list.
And at the time, how many other cities, how many other places were doing something like this?
At the time that we did the vulnerability index, I think we were about the 27th city on the list. And the really, I think, heartbreaking thing about what we learned when we did that count, we found out that at that time, in our 807, we had more people who were chronically homeless 20 years or longer than even Los Angeles Skid Row.
Wow. Why is that, you think?
I think because, all of the rural areas around us from, you know, North Carolina, South Carolina, I think there's a misperception. People think, oh, once you start doing homeless services, people move here for homeless services. They really don't. People move here for opportunity. Charlotte was the center of opportunity in, you know, a southern region. People would come from Lancaster, South Carolina, and other small towns thinking that they would get a construction job. And all of a sudden they would get a job and then, you know, their uncle would kick them off the couch and then they had nowhere to go. And I think that is a repeating story. It is not true that people move for good soup. They really don't. And in the 10 years that I was working and doing this, I never met one person who said, gosh, you know, when I grow up, I want to be homeless. And I really hope I can be homeless in Charlotte, North Carolina, because they do it right.
Yeah. That leads me to ask someone, though. Is the way homelessness happens or the way it's treated or any of those sort of things different in the South than they are in other places? Because now you've studied some of these other places as well. Are there anything that stands out about the way homelessness works here?
Well, I think we were very behind is the wrong word. We were doing a lot of things. We were not trying the housing first model. We were not trying some of the best practices. We've certainly caught up with that. We are different in the South in that you can't actually get a check from the state. In New York and New Jersey, there are actually larger types of checks that you would get to try and help you through a period of homelessness. That doesn't exist. So I would think that is very different than other places that we talked to in Seattle, in Salt Lake City. They kept telling us, oh, we'll get your state to kick in. And that was to do that would have meant writing a white paper and changing legislation. And we decided that we would probably be better off to try and raise the money than to try and change public policy. So,
yeah. When we come back, Kathy Izzard talks about the life of Chili Willie, one of Charlotte's most famous and most notorious street people. That and more ahead on Southbound.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com.
I'm Sarah D'Elia. For the past year, I've been following the case of a Charlotte woman who was sexually assaulted by a stranger nearly 3 years ago and still is struggling to find answers.
And it's just been an absolute nightmare. So I don't know what's going to happen. I really don't at this point.
She says WFAE's new investigative podcast launches May 31st. Find out more at WFAE.org/she says.
So I want to talk about, or I want you to talk about, some of those first folks that you brought in. And to start off with, a guy that you name in the book is Bill Halsey, who literally lived in a hole in the ground. Can you? But it was sort of an elaborate construction. Can you explain that?
He did. Bill Halsey was someone that we'd been serving since the day we opened in 1994, which is when the Irvin Ministry Center opened their doors.
And so by the point Moore Place opened, it had been 20-plus years.
Yes, because Moore Place opened in January 29th, 2012. So, yes. And everyone loved Bill. We'd been serving him soup. He was so polite. He had these sky blue eyes and always a brown cowboy hat, polite and gentle. And we were wanting to help him because he also had one of the most unusual homeless stories in Charlotte. He had some mental health challenges. And being in a shelter where there's 300 men all trying to sleep at night just increased his anxiety and exasperated his issues. And so he went out by the railroad tracks and kind of solved his problem in the only way he knew, which is he dug an 8 by 8 foot hole in the ground. And he lived in that 8 by 8 foot hole in the ground until the day he moved into Moore Place.
And not only was it a hole in the ground, it was like there was a concrete slab there, right? That had been sort of a loading dock for trains.
He did.
So it was actually pretty remarkable engineering in some ways.
It was. There was a lot about him. And I found out eventually that he had the same job that I had, which he was a graphic designer. And so he was creative, and there was a cement slab that was out by the railroad tracks. And instead of pitching a tent on top of it, he decided that would make an excellent roof. And so he dug his 8 by 8 foot hole in the ground beneath that concrete barrier and lived there until the day he moved in.
And the day he moved in, that kind of brings in another story about a woman that you guys called the mailbox angel, right?
Yeah. So when I tell a lot of stories in the book of people who came to this project, who were drawn to it. And as I said, you know, kids who did lemonade stands to Davidson College students who rode their bike across the country and sent us $6,000. But my favorite story was what we called our mystery mailbox angel. And I went to our mailbox one day at the Urban Ministry Center, and there was a pink envelope for me. And I opened it up, and there was a card, and it kind of a Hallmark card. And I opened it up, and a few dollars fell out, you know, $8. And there was no name and no note except that someone had written, "May God bless and multiply this small amount." And that was it. And at the time, I remember it like made my day. I thought, oh my gosh, who's sending us their last $8 to believe in this crazy Don Quixote dream that we have of building a building? And then 2 weeks later, another one. Same kind of, you know, no message except for "May God bless and multiply this small amount." And I kept getting those every 2 weeks, every 3 weeks. And it was a different amount of money, always just a few dollars, always a different kind of prayer or blessing. And we didn't know. And even when Moore Place opened, they started, instead of coming to the Irvin Ministry Center, they started coming to the Moore Place address. But Housing Bill Halsey solved the mailbox angel story because we realized one day we got one of the envelopes, and in the corner it said Francis Halsey. And we realized that Dale had a mom who loved him and who lived in Charlotte but didn't know how to find him. And so she just sent her prayers and her $5, and she didn't know if it was going to help her son, but she knew it was going to help somebody's son. And it turned out that Bill Halsey was Francis's son.
That's a pretty cool story. I also want you to talk a little bit about a guy who we in Charlotte, certainly if you lived in Charlotte for any length of time, knew as Chilly Willie.
Yeah. Chilly Willie, and I had a connection even before I started this, and I didn't know it. And I think Chilly Willie was the first time I realized that homeless people don't happen in abstract, that they have families and people who love them but really don't know how to help them. And Chilly Willie's brother turned out to be my plumber. And one day he was working at my house and said he needed to leave to help his brother. And I said, "Well, just have your brother come here. You know, he can come to the house." And he said, "No, I'm going to meet him in the park. My brother lives in the park." And once we described him, we realized we were talking about Charlotte's most famous homeless person, whose name was Larry Major. I learned from his brother, Johnny, that I learned a little more about Larry's story. But he'd been on the streets probably as long as Bill Halsey, a couple of decades, and kind of the wildest child. If you saw him, you might be a little scared of him. He had this wild kind of frizzy blonde hair, and he would be braided from time to time. I think he would stop by some beauty parlors and they would braid his hair. And he also had a tattooed of Harley Davidson on his forehead, across his forehead.
Yeah, the Harley Davidson logo.
Logo directly across his forehead. So you couldn't miss Chilly Willie. And the other thing about Chilly Willie is that he wandered the neighborhoods of Charlotte. If you lived in one part of town, you were sure that that's the only place he went. But if you talk to somebody in the other part of town, he was there too. He wandered the entire city.
There were YouTube videos of him out there. Right, certainly were back then. And in some of them, he's friendly. He's singing songs. He plays guitar a little bit, that sort of thing. You could just look at those videos and say, oh, there's just a nice, sweet guy. But it's at other times, he could be really super abusive, yelling at people, screaming at people, kind of following him down the street, the kind of person you would cross the street to avoid. And so there were, you know, he was sort of legendary in a good way and a bad way when you guys took him in.
He was both and. And I think anyone listening who has a relative with any kind of addiction or drinking problem can understand that you know someone who is sweet as can be sober and then is a mean drunk. And I think that probably described Larry in a pretty good way, that he had his share of run-ins with all kinds of law enforcement in Charlotte and all kinds of people. But at the same time, he would be that guy at the soup kitchen who would sing, you know, Charlie Daniels songs to my kids. So he was both and. So he moved in on February 14th, showed up sober that day, stone cold sober, because he said that he wanted to start his new life that way. And he also said that he was formally changing his name back, that he no longer, once now that he was housed, wanted to be Chilly Willie, that he was now Larry William Major, and that we would address him as Larry from then on.
And I know at first there, it seemed like he didn't fit in well, right? Or people were wary of him and he was wary of them to some extent, right?
Well, I think, we created this family and community in a building that some of them knew each other from the street, some did not. There, you tend to know, I think there's a lot of camaraderie that happens. But yeah, I think being in close quarters every day with Larry when you couldn't walk away from him like you could on the streets, I think caused some consternation. And he was both and when he was in the building. It wasn't perfect. He could be great some days and not others. The executive director at the time was a woman named Carolyn Chambray Hammock, and he would go probably, you know, every other week and hand her his key and say, I can't do this anymore. And she would hand it back and she said, yeah, you can, Larry. So it wasn't without its struggles. And again, anyone listening who has a family member with addiction can probably imagine exactly what it was like.
Yeah. And how did you see him transform once he got there?
Well, I think there was the belief in himself started a little bit of that his life didn't have to play out on the streets, that maybe he didn't have to be that that character that he was, that he maybe didn't have to drink as much as he did. And I think that was the way that he was tracking. I think it was a struggle. It was certainly not perfect. He was definitely going back and forth towards the end of life. But for those who haven't read the book and are listening now, I'll say that Larry lived with us for about 9 months, and then he was struck by a car, and he was killed on the streets. And his funeral was probably one of the most remarkable events I'll ever go to, because more than 1,000 people signed the guest book at the funeral that day. It was held in a church that was founded by Larry's father over in a part of Charlotte. And at that funeral were policemen and bus drivers and housewives and artists and tattoo artists and beauticians and just the broadest range of charlatans all gathered in one room to remember the life of a man who struck people in all kinds of ways, and a lot of good ways. People telling stories. I was standing in line for probably over an hour to speak to the family, and people were telling stories in line about how a woman in particular said he walked her daughter safely to her car after it broke down and had helped get her help. And someone else talking about how he had talked to his little boy about, you know, staying in school and flying right because he hadn't. So I think there was that good and bad present even to the last day, but he really affected so many people. A Facebook page was started in his honor. You can still see all of that today. He really was a community talisman, I think, in a way that not many people realized.
Yeah. How do you think this program has affected people in ways you didn't expect?
Probably the most remarkable example is a woman named Carlotta that we housed in the first couple of months when we opened the building. And she just recently moved out because she put a down payment on a home that she's bought. And so she's completely moved out. So I think that is, you know, what you would wish for everyone. But just in the folks who really will be staying with the program or staying with More Place long term because of their disabilities, I think that extraordinary life of ordinary is really possible. And we have folks who were the first residents to move in, and now they're the RAs. So when new people move in, they're kind of the buddy system of explaining what this community's like and the things that they need. So I think that's been kind of remarkable too.
So they're RAs like in the dorm or something?
Yes.
Oh, that's cool. I know you talked about there being sort of measurables at the beginning. You know, you're trying to figure out who qualifies as chronically homeless and that sort of thing. Now, there are measurables on this other end, too, for what y'all consider to be success in these programs.
Well, success to us is someone taking care of themselves and being a good neighbor and going back to self-sufficiency. That is success. So anyone living in More Place, everyone takes care of themselves, is a good neighbor. They cook, they clean for themselves. So that is a measure of success. I think we grade ourselves on success on working our way through that 807. More than 500 have been housed since 2012. So I guess that would give us a B minus at this point. We still have some to go for that final 300. So I think that is success for us. And then hopefully really as a community working on some of the root causes of homelessness, which are affordable housing. And how do we as a community try and find more places that are affordable for people to live based on varying incomes? And right now we have a struggle with that in our community and in a lot of cities.
You talked about 500 people now. Is that people who have lived there, who live there now and have lived there at some point?
Well, we've expanded. When we first built More Place, it was 85 units, individual apartments. They're very simple. They're 366 square feet, individual kitchens and baths. And we expanded it in 2015 to 120 units. So there's 120 people on that property. But we have more than 300 who are in scattered sites. So they're in apartments all over the city. We've broken down that barrier of working with landlords, and now they're all over.
When you went back to people, did you say it's worked over here?
Yes.
Would you be willing to try it?
Yes. So, I mean, there's a lot to be able to show people More Place. I think as a community, Charlotte really understands More Place. It's a term. They understand permanent supportive housing, and they understand scattered site, that there are people who are living all over Charlotte. You don't just give someone a key to an apartment and say, have a nice life. There are case managers who check in and help all over the city, and that is happening. So that's where the 500 comes from, is different programs as well as More Place, getting people that are chronically homeless housed.
Since all this started for y'all, how has this played out around the country? Has this been something that's been more and more popular? Popular is the right word.
Yeah, well, I think it's considered best practice now. I mean, when 10 years ago, when we were having conversations about chronically homeless and permanent supportive housing, and we were explaining terms, and that it really is not the case anymore, certainly in Charlotte, certainly across the country. People know what Housing First is. There's more units that are coming online every day. So I think it is definitely considered best practice and not kind of a new idea anymore. And I think the federal government recognizes it such. So communities are rewarded in terms of federal dollars, those that are implementing Housing First and housing veterans and housing the chronically homeless. All of that is kind of at the forefront of homeless services.
Are there plans in Charlotte to do new things? Is there other stuff in the works?
We would love at the Urban Ministry Center to probably do one more what we called single site, like More Place, expand our scattered site, have more units available.
Raise $10 million again?
Yeah, maybe $10 million. but I think really we hope to be part of the conversation community-wide about affordable housing, that it's not our average rent in Charlotte for an apartment, I think, is $1,200 now. Rents have gone up 36% in 5 years. So whether you're chronically homeless or whether you're a family of four getting by, I mean, that's affecting everyone. And the fact is, people become homeless when they can't find an affordable place to live. So that is affecting all of us as we build all these luxury skyrise apartments, which are beautiful and they make our downtown look great. We are at a lack of places for a lot of people to go, and we as a community have to address that.
So I want to kind of circle back around to how this affected you. I know you did. You talked in the book, even though you tried very hard to resist, you could not help but find a spiritual dimension in all this at some point.
Oh, I think that was, again, I guess the last reason that I wrote the book is I needed to be honest about what happened. I needed to first say, this was not my idea. I mean, in the beginning, it was a career change and I wanted to do this, but this was started by Denver Moore starting some sort of spark in me. And I had grown up in a home that was very Presbyterian and very faith-based. And like many, I rejected that and tried to move as far away as possible. But then in this strange pull, ended up coming right back to it because I really could not be, there was not all coincidence. There was so much faith in the people who came to us. There was faith in the people experiencing homelessness who believed in us. There was, you had to have faith to think that this was ever going to work. And so it really restored a different kind of faith in me of believing in something bigger than myself. And I hope that's the thread that people see in this book. And I hope it starts conversation because I think I was, like many, you know, there's on this side, there's believing in nothing. And then there's people who were so sure in their belief on the far side. And I couldn't really hear either one. And I've found a middle ground for myself so that I definitely believe in something bigger than myself. And I hope maybe this book is a bridge book for other people into exploring what they believe.
So I want to talk some book nerd stuff for a little bit.
Okay,
so this is the second go-round for this book.
It is.
You first published it when?
I self-published this in 2016. I wrote this book over 6 years. I was not writing it while I was raising the money and working on the building and actually working on housing. I wrote it in reflection after to say, what was that? That was an amazing couple of years. And what was that? So I started writing more reflection to myself. And then as it drew out, it started to become a book. And I had little seeds of ideas that it would be published. But then it's much harder than you think to get an agent and to get a publisher to care. So finally, at the end of 6 years, I just put it out myself. I self-published it. I've said that I think it's easier to build an apartment building and raise $10 million than it is to publish a book. But then it started taking off in ways I can't really explain. I think being honest about what happened, being honest about my childhood and writing about my mother, the mental health aspect of this has struck a chord with people. I think the faith aspect and then just the general miracle of feel-good story of what we did. So the fact that it sold a lot in Charlotte and elsewhere, I started speaking around the South to different places. I ended up working with an agent here who sold the book in 30 days. And so now it's going to be re-released June 26th. And it's going to be an ebook, an audiobook finally for all the people who said, why don't you do that? Well, that's very hard to do self-published, but now the big guys can do it and it'll be coming out June 26th.
And what will you be doing behind this? Will you be doing more stuff like this? Will you be going around places? What will you be doing?
Well, you're my very first podcast,
all
Tommy.
Right,
so
fantastic.
Thank you so much for that.
And now you're in the club.
Yeah. So yes, I will be. I've got some speaking engagements around the South. I'm going to be doing some things in Northeast and out West a little bit, and seeing where it goes from there. Seeing, I guess I call it planting book seeds and seeing what happens with it.
So. Okay. So I want to go all the way back to the beginning. We first started talking about you as a kid in your house with your mom having issues that you didn't understand at the time and didn't understand until much later. So everything that's happened since then and all that you've done to help build More Place and those things, how has that changed the way you see your childhood? And has it in any way changed the way you think about what it means to have a home?
So much in that question. I think, yes, the process of writing this book, I've said, took two editors and two therapists. Because I definitely, when I was writing about
well, it's good that you balanced them out.
It did. Yeah, two of each. I think in writing about all, I was writing about things that honestly I hadn't thought and much less talked about in 30 years. But I knew that I had to understand who was I that day when Denver says to me, What are you going to do about it? I mean, why did I listen? Like, why didn't I just go home and go to sleep, right? And I think a lot of that had to do with growing up in home and seeing my mother and knowing, had my dad not been there, or my grandparents been there to pick up the pieces and find care and help, that there's a good chance my mom could have been one of the homeless women. I don't know if she'd been sleeping under a car like a friend Helen, but when Denver said that to me, I thought, yeah, you know, maybe it's not my job, but it's no one's job. So I'm going to make it my job from now on and to see what we can do. And the second part of your question?
Oh, do you see home? It's the whole concept of home differently now.
Yeah, I certainly see the way I grew up very differently. And I don't know that I see it any more broken today than I did, because I think I did have so many redeeming parts and so many pieces. I definitely see my mother differently. I had an anger with her that I couldn't quite get to. But through all the process of the writing, I think I found a forgiveness in myself for kind of that anger that I had with her that was always between us. She did not ask for this, you know, just like it's a 1 in 5 problem, mental health issue. She did not wake up and say, gosh, I hope I can, you know, interrupt my life with 16 years of being lost. So I think I did find this softness, this forgiveness, and also realize how resilient she was. I mean, and I look at all of the folks that I worked with over the last 10 years who turned to alcohol or drugs or other ways to cope with the voices in their head. And my mom turned to her Bible. My mom turned to faith. My mom turned to prayer. And I think how different my life would have been had she made different choices. So I'm grateful that she was that strong woman who was resilient and taught resiliency in us.
Thank you, Kathy. I really appreciate it. A few years ago, I spoke at an event for the Urban Ministry Center. Moore Place had opened just a few months before, and I went out there to meet some of the residents. So I sat in the lobby waiting for somebody else to come down, and walked Larry Major, a.k.a. Chili Willie. Chili Willie, the guy I used to see on the street, was terrifying. Larry Major, the guy I met at Moore Place, was gentle and funny. We talked about photography and music and the Harley Davidson tattoo that stretched across his forehead. He wished he hadn't gotten the tattoo. Maybe 2 weeks later, as Kathy Izzard described in our conversation, Larry was hit by a car and died. He had not beaten all his demons in those 8 months he lived at Moore Place. But there, he could hold them off long enough to crack the shell of his alcoholic anger and show people the human being underneath. Every one of us, from the richest CEO to the most broken soul in the gutter, is more alike than different. It's a simple truth. As simple as the truth that we are all better off with a door to close at night and a light to turn off and a place to call home. Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our producer is Nick Delacanal. Our web manager is Jennifer Lang. Our audience engagement producer is Joni Deutsch. And our main theme music comes from Josh Turner. If you have any thoughts about the show, ideas for future guests, or ways to mess with Texas, email me at ttomlinson@wfae.org. You can listen to this and all other episodes of Southbound on the NPR One app, iTunes, or wherever else you listen to podcasts. You can also find Southbound on WFAE.org, where each episode has show notes with links with more information on that week's guest. Between episodes, look for the Southbound Radio Hour with a playlist of music based on the most recent episode. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, committed to technology-driven radiation therapy and treatments for cancer. Details at treatcancer.com.